Here we go. Here we go. God help us. Seems like a number of people have been looking forward to this topic, and we'll see how it goes. Maybe the most difficult one, not this week, but in the coming weeks, for us to talk about, for me to present. So, what happens after we die? Imagine some spooky music playing. We've got the tunnel of light here. I didn't have any Twilight Zone music or spooky music, because only I would hear it on my iPad. So we're going to be a little lighthearted tonight in a few places, thanks to Dr. Bookman primarily. But we're also going to be talking about something pretty heavy. Pretty heavy indeed. So I think we have a copy here, Matt. I don't know if a lot of you know Matt. That Matt has a copy of the book that inspired this whole thing, Heaven is for Real. So our talk about near-death experiences in the coming weeks, I titled, Is Heaven is for Real for Real? Just because it sounds kind of neat. An Orthodox Reflection on Near-Death Experiences. But we're going to be talking a lot about a lot more than that book. And in fact, before we get started tonight on the subject, we're going to spend a little bit of time on introduction. Not even really to the theme, but how to be thinking in some terms as we delve into this. If you have questions, I know there's going to be lots of questions, I think, please ask them, but let's ask questions that are about the topic that we're talking about as opposed to what we're going to be talking about 3 weeks from now. You know what I mean? I know we all want the answers. And, you know, I'm not going to give you a lot of answers. This is an ineffable and mysterious topic, so we're going to reflect upon it, and then maybe each of us will have some resources to answer some of those questions for ourselves. We'll certainly give you some guidance. But first I want to share with you just some of the sources that we're going to be using, things that I've read or am in the process of reading that are going to be informing what we're talking about. The first book is called Life After Life. We're going to talk about that a little bit more tonight, by Raymond Moody, MD, PhD, in 1975. An important book in this subject area. Oops. The other book, sorry, I'm rusty, is Evidence of the Afterlife by Jeffrey Long, The Science of Near-Death Experiences. In the coming weeks, we will get to one that's very familiar to many people, Heaven is for Real by Todd Burpo, pastor of Colton Burpo, who had this experience, published in 2010. Proof of Heaven by Evan Alexander, PhD, that Joni and Mark put me on to, loaned me their copy. 90 Minutes in Heaven by Pastor Don Piper. These are three books that are first-hand experiences of a near-death experience. The other two books are studies on near-death experiences. These are actually near-death experiences themselves. Then getting into some more orthodox sources, we are going to look at some information in Life After Death by Metropolitan Horotheos of Lakos, published in 1996. One of the most premier living orthodox theologians today. We will also be looking at Dialogue Number 4 by Gregory the Great, who is Patriarch of Rome. St. Gregory lived in 540 to 604. He's the author of our pre-sanctified liturgy. So in the late 500s, he wrote Dialogue 4. It has to do a lot with what we're talking about. And The Soul After Death by Father Seraphim Rose, who looks very in-depth at the many aspects of the near-death experience. And then finally, unbelievable for many, but actually a true experience, as some of you have read, some of you picked up, there's copies of them upstairs. I'm going to make more copies, and during that time when we talk about this, I'll give you, that'll be the handout for that week, an Orthodox near-death experience. It occurred and was published in the late 1800s, and then was republished in a Moscow journal in 1916, and then various other near-death and after-death experiences from church history and from the lives of the saints. So those are our sources. Near-death experiences, and I know most of you, I'm assuming most of you understand what I mean by that. We're going to unpack that a little bit more, but we're going to see in a way how and why we understand many aspects of what that term near-death experience means. But near-death experiences present some challenges. This is a cartoon that Dr. Bookman, Reader Thomas, sends me often, Pearls Before Swine. What I think is going to happen to me when I die by pig, who's really a wretched character, he's a pig, a wretched character and really not bright. And then his friend, is that Zebra? I don't know who he's from. Okay. Gee, that's a pretty heavy topic to write about. What did you conclude? What happens? Salvation, reincarnation, I'd rather not say right now. I fall over. I'm embarrassed. Pretty funny, but in a way, pig represents the piggish, the fleshly, the secular humanist, and the scientific materialist. Now, pop in anytime, ask questions, let's be a little free. Secular humanism is, you know, secular, not religious, not spiritual. Humanism, that secular humanism is the reigning theology, the reigning worldview of the day, that man is in the center. And secular humanist. Or scientific materialism. That science can tell us everything that we need to know. And what it tells us is the only thing that exists is that which we can see and touch and hear and taste. The material world. So there is no spiritual world. So I'll fall over when I die. That's the answer to what happens when I die. Is what the secular humanists and especially the scientific materialists would say. Many of our scientists, many of our doctors today. And near-death experiences challenge greatly this worldview. Some humanists and some scientists, as we see, are going to be opening themselves up to this. They're researching this. They're really looking at it. It's challenging this idea that death ends with me falling over, that all there is this life. But we also might ask ourselves, as we look a little bit more, do near-death experiences pose a potential challenge to Christian beliefs, to traditional Christian beliefs? Do they? I mean, certainly, heaven is for real, doesn't it? It's totally Protestant packaged, evangelical Protestant theology. 90 Minutes in Heaven, even more so. But the other book that we're going to be looking at,
Proof of Heaven.
You're going to have all the afterlife and life after life and life after death, Proof of Heaven, Evidence of Heaven. All the titles are basically the same thing. I get them mixed up in my head. Proof of Heaven is something that if we read it with some discernment, it does seem to imply some challenges to a Christian worldview. Okay? So with that in mind, I want us to keep 8 things in mind. These are written down on here. These don't really, if we get far enough tonight, we'll see a few of them being applied. But I want us to keep these things in mind in the coming weeks. First of all, that God is love. God is love. God is merciful. God desires not the death of the sinner, but that he should return and live. And that view fits with a lot of what we hear in near-death experiences. But there's a bit more to the Christian view. This is Christ speaking. And he said to them, thus it is written, and thus it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name to all nations beginning at Jerusalem. And you are witnesses of these things. The apostles were witnesses of Christ's explanation about the meaning of his death and resurrection. And he's commanding them, preach repentance and remission of sins in Jesus' name. Elsewhere he says, if you love me, keep my commandments. And his commandment here is preaching repentance and remission of sins. Okay? We're going to go back a little bit into the Old Testament. There shall not be found among you anyone who practices divination or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who conjures spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord your God, and the Lord your God will destroy them before you. Okay? Sorcery, magic, consulting psychics, consulting mediums. In the Old Testament, by the command of God, was what we call a sin unto death. If you fell into this, your life was required of you by God because your continued existence defiled Israel. You had to be killed and burned. Okay? Why? Because contact with the unseen world, not at the initiation of God, but at the initiation of the will of man, is very dangerous. But even if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we preach to you, let him be anathema. Heard that word before, cursed. That's St. Paul speaking to the Galatians. But I fear, lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. Sorry for the typo. I fixed that typo, but it's still there. For if he who comes preaches another, Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. And Lord, haven't we seen this? So again, St. Paul speaking now to the Corinthians, the church he had found. He's afraid that if another Jesus, another gospel is preached, he's afraid that that might be enticing, that people might accept it. They might put up with it. It might begin to change them. It might begin to spread. And then finally, again, St. Paul speaking to the church in Corinth. For Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness. And then finally, the eighth thing to keep in mind, we're going to talk a little bit more about, is paradigms of observation. Patterns or schemes of observation. I want, in a truly orthodox way, to point out all the good that is coming from books like this. And there's a lot of good here. We either want to tend to throw something out and say, well, no, that's not good. Or we want to accept it wholeheartedly without discernment. So before we look at the good and maybe discern some of the things that maybe are questionable, some things that maybe not be the kind of spirit that we're to listen to, I want us to be contemplating these things, keeping these things, the words of Christ, the words of St. Paul who received the revelation of Christ, the commandments of God from the test. I want us to keep those in our hearts as we go on. Paradigms of observation. Okay, what the heck does that mean? It's a paradigm of observation. What's Father Christopher talking about? Well, when we look at things, when we see things around us, we tend to make sense of them. We've got flat Earth. I love, for those of you who live in the 60s, Spaceship Earth there, right? The flat Earth, okay? Versus a spherical Earth, okay? What's a paradigm of observation? A flat Earth versus a spherical Earth. Well, what I mean by that is that for many, many, many centuries, not in the ancient Greek, not in the Christian East, we knew the world, we hadn't gone all the way around, we knew the world was a sphere, the ancient philosophers knew that. But in the European West, for a long time, you know, Earth looks flat to me. I walk all that way, you know, I walked 3 months that way and I didn't come around again to the same place, so the Earth must be flat. It makes sense. It fits our observations. I mean, who doesn't think the earth is really flat? Or...
it isn't?
They tell us that it isn't, but I don't believe them. Or another paradigm of observation. Geocentric. That means the earth is the center. See, the earth, this is also what we thought for a long time. The earth is in the middle. And the sun orbits the earth. The sun goes around the earth. The earth is in the middle. All the planets go around the earth. Versus a heliocentric model. The sun's in the middle. The sun's in the middle. Okay? And the earth goes around the sun. Well, we know which one is true. We know the heliocentric model is true. We know that the earth is a sphere, is a globe. It's not flat. So what does this mean? Well, a lot of people thought that this was the model of the universe for many, many centuries. It fit the data. It fit the evidence. It fit their observation. But what this paradigms of observation tell us is that just because we observe or experience or see or feel something does not necessarily mean that we will interpret it correctly based on our own observations. Or another way to say it is, what kind of worldview is informing how we understand what we observe? Does that make sense? It means that, you know, before Galileo came, this was my worldview. And then I would look at all the data and all the evidence and everything, and it fit into this plan for me. Does that make sense? In a way, there was a worldview. There were decisions being made before I observed, before I saw the data. And it takes something outside of my observation, something beyond me, in this case, science, satellites, those guys in the, whatever our space station is called, or up in the space shuttle, who take pictures of the earth and send it back to us and say, hey guys, the earth is round, and by the way, it goes around the sun. It takes something more than my limited observations to arrive at the truth. What does this have to do with us? Well, we have natural observation. We observe the things that are around us in nature. We're going to be observing some things, that people are observing some things, that are very natural to human life and the human being when the soul leaves the body. But that is different than divine revelation. There's natural observation. There's divine revelation. There is what good intention people, and they're finding true things or discovering truths that we've known for a long time, parts of truths, by natural observation. But there's a difference between this and this. Divine revelation. A deeper mystery. Or even, can you hand me that? There's a difference, and we'll talk about that more, between this and this. There's a huge difference. God commanded these people to speak and to write of their divine revelation. God didn't command Todd Burpo to write this. He decided to write it. And it's a nice story. It's made a lot of money, and they're sure marketing it well. Not their intent necessarily, their primary intent. But God didn't command this to come into being. He did command this to come into being. So we need to keep some of these things in mind. Does that make sense? What I'm saying kind of makes sense? Okay. All right. No questions before we dive in.
Mark.
He has this treasure chest of these things somewhere on the internet. So we have a woman on the table. This is before. This is from Farside. I don't know, my favorite comics growing up. But the doctors are being kind of impish and turning off the lights and shining a flashlight in her face. And now she's on TV afterwards. Suddenly I saw a bright light at the end of a tunnel.
There's that bright light again.
There's that bright light. Okay. A man is dying. And as he reaches the point of greatest physical distress, he hears himself pronounced dead by his doctor. He begins to hear an uncomfortable noise, a loud ringing or buzzing in his ears. and at the same time feels himself moving very rapidly through a long, dark tunnel. After this, he suddenly finds himself outside his own physical body, but is still in the immediate physical environment. And he sees his own body from a distance as though he is a spectator. He watches the resuscitation attempt from this unusual vantage point and is in a state of emotional upheaval. After a while, he collects himself and becomes more accustomed to his odd condition. He notices that he still has a body, but one very different, of a very different nature, with very different powers from the physical body he has left behind. Soon other things begin to happen. Others come to meet and to help him. He glimpses the spirits of relatives and friends who have already died, and with a loving, warm spirit of a kind he has never encountered before, a being of light appears before him. This being asks him a question non-verbally. They hear it in their thoughts. They communicate in their thoughts. To make him evaluate his life and helps him along by showing him a panoramic, instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. At some point, he finds himself approaching some sort of barrier or border, apparently representing the limit between earthly life and the next life. Yet he finds that he must go back to the earth, that the time for his death has not yet come. At this point, he resists, for by now he is taken up with his experiences in the afterlife and does not want to return. He is overwhelmed by intense feelings of joy, love, and peace. Despite his attitude, though, he somehow reunites with his physical body and lives. Later, he tries to tell others, but he has trouble doing so. In the first place, he can find no human words adequate to describe these unearthly episodes. He also finds that others scoff, so he stops telling other people. Still, the experience affects his life profoundly, especially his views about death and its relationship to life. Does this sound familiar? Does this seem
common?
Does it? I mean, you kind of familiar with this? Okay. Amanda, Denise, does this seem kind of?
It's like that movie, It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
Except he doesn't leave his body.
No.
We should do a whole series on It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah. It's an entirely Orthodox movie. Yeah. My favorite movie in the whole world. But this is a near-death experience. This seems like someone's experience, doesn't it? That they've written down. It's not. This is the model of a typical near-death experience compiled by Raymond Moody, PhD, MD. Okay? No one had this exact experience. So near-death experiences. Want some spooky music here. We're rising from the body. In the beginning. Well, in 1975, to be exact. A man named Raymond Moody and a book.
I was waiting for more to come over there.
There we go.
Perfect.
Oh, it's spooky. And a book. Did you load that up?
No.
You just found it.
It's a ringtone.
Keep it handy. Life After Life by Raymond Moody, MD, PhD. The first popular, and I've been swimming in this ocean for too long. NDE, near death experience. OBE, out of body experience. NDEer, near death experiencer, someone who's experienced a near death experience. So, Life After Life, 1975, the first popular study on near death experiences published in the United States. Based on 150 accounts of three different types of near-death experiences. First, experiences of people who were resuscitated after clinical death. By clinical death, we mean the heart is stopped. And unless there is intervention, the person is dead. Okay? Second, experiences of people who came close to clinical death. People who had a very traumatic experience. Maybe they were going to die, or they would have died had there not been some divine or medical intervention. Different than the first kind. We'll talk about that in later classes. And three, secondhand accounts of experiences of those who have died. Someone's dying and Mark's there as the doctor, or Michael's there as the caregiver, and they see things and begin to experience things. They relate this to them. The person does die, and they later relate it to us. In the church, this is what we have primarily. Not entirely, but primarily. Dr. Moody, was a physician, and he began to, like the other man who's the author of this book, a few decades later, be interested in these reports that people would come back and say, you know, I was floating over my body. I saw them resuscitating me. There was no lapse of consciousness. And that's an important thing. One of the positive things that give us hope, that unless someone's completely drugged to alleviate pain, which, not you, forgive me if I cast a bad light on the medical profession, but a lot of doctors over-medicate for pain. And the person's unconscious, completely. All of the experiences show us, both in the church and these other experiences reported, that there is not one moment, not even a fraction of a second, of a lapse into unconsciousness as a person dies. It gets to the moment of their greatest physical distress. We'll hear some great descriptions of this, the most detailed I've heard in the Russian that happened to. Feeling this gravity, the weight of the world pulling on his body, but there's something else in him that's not being pulled down. And at the moment of discomfort, pressure, he feels fine. And he's wondering, why are all those people gathered around something over there on the other side of the room? And then he comes to realize, wait a minute, they're gathered around a body on the other side of the room. And wait a minute, that body looks a lot like me. What the heck is going on? And then they may freak out for a little while. It'll be very calm and peaceful. But there's not a fraction of a second that the person lapses into unconsciousness unless they're drugged. If they're drugged, then once their soul leaves their body, they're completely conscious. They're not groggy. So anyway, a rabbit trail. Moody focused primarily on the 50 experiences of the first two types. Those who were... My laser pointer isn't working here. Those who were resuscitated after clinical death and those who came close to clinical death. Okay? And his study was based on extensive personal interviews with these people. He found these people, he interviewed them, he sat down with them, and that actually led to him getting a PhD. He was in the process of getting his PhD when he wrote Life After Life. Moody, based on his study and talking to these different people, Dr. Moody compiled a 15-point model of the ideal near-death experience. Okay, it's in your notes. We'll go over it in a minute. Most of those who experience the near-death experience most of the points on there, but none of them experience them all. The near-death experience is kind of different for everyone, slightly. And he's got 50 people. He says, well, this is kind of what's happening most of the time. So he's put it together in 15 points. Not one person he interviewed had all the points happen to them, just like that compiled ideal near-death experience. That not all of that stuff happened to any single person who experienced a near-death experience. He compiled this. Okay.
Maybe I'm getting ahead, but did he ask them all the same questions so he led them into the answers, or no?
No, because what we're going to get to before, and that's, we'll get there in a minute. I'll ask that question again.
All right.
Moody admittedly knew of no historical accounts of near-death experiences. These guys are approaching this like it's a new phenomenon, primarily because now we have paddles Now we have CPR. Now we have drugs that can bring people back. Now we have the medical technology, which is true. That's why it's happening a lot more. But he says, I know of no historical accounts of this. I know where there's plenty. Okay? But he's open to admitting that. He saw the near-death experience as counter to the classical Protestant Christian view of the afterlife. In his book, he does quote the Bible to support some of these points that we're going to talk about, and he completely misses the point. He completely misunderstands what's being said in Scripture at that point. And you would agree with the basic things. He's coming to it with his agenda. And so he turned to works like the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Has anyone heard of that book? The Tibetan Book of the Dead. Compiled in the 8th century from earlier. It's a Buddhist book about the journey the soul takes after death, the experiences it will have. It's striking in its similarities to modern-day near-death experiences. But then it goes on to other strange, chaotic, weird experiences that happen like days and weeks and months after death. But it's Buddhist. Okay, he turned those into other occult sources. By occult, I don't mean satanic or devilish, but the occult of, satanic and devilish indirectly. Emanuel Swedenborg was not a Christian, but he called himself a Christian. He had many experiences. He wrote about it in the 1600s. Very similar to today's New Age ideas and astral projection and things like that. So he's turning to these for further investigation. Okay? This one's for you, Mark Klein. Moody was a Methodist. Moody was a Methodist. Okay? He admits that at the beginning of this book.
That writes him off.
Maybe he's a Methodist. Well, what does it tell us? It tells us that, I mean, this is an assumption, but there are many good Methodists out there. My mother-in-law is one of them. But he was a liberal Methodist. He has a liberal worldview, a liberal pseudo-Christian mindset coming to this information. We'll see how easily he misunderstands. Okay. Within a few years, Life After Life had sold 2 million copies. Moody invented the term near-death experience. In the area of near-death experiences, the influence of this one book cannot be overstated. Because the reason, you know what the tunnel of light is, the tunnel of light? When I say, I see the tunnel of light. If I do that, you know Father Christopher, he's dying, right?
Yeah.
It's actually not, it's a tunnel of darkness in Moody with a light at the end. But the reason we know what near-death experience means, we can talk about the tunnel of light, the being of light, all this stuff. The reason, okay, is because this book, it was a culture-changing book, okay? Did Moody lead those people in questions and asking them? I don't think so. Primarily, he lets them tell about their experiences. But there wasn't a life after life before he was talking to them. There wasn't a model of near-death experience that we all know bits and pieces of. It's a part of our culture now. That didn't exist before this book. Okay? No one talked about it. Okay. Moody's 15-point model of an ideal near-death experience. First of all, ineffability. Those who come back, it's difficult to put the experience in human words. The experience transcends human words. It is inexpressible. Okay? And authentic. Maybe this is an authentic experience, spiritual experience. But, the saints, when they come back, St. Paul comes back from the third heaven, says, I saw things not lawful to speak. There are no human words or concepts to speak of these things. Okay? Second point. Hearing the news. These are all points that we just read in that story that he put together. Someone has died. They can't, when they come back, explain the experience in words. Words seem to fail, but they hear themselves pronounced dead on the table. Okay? But though there's some maybe freaking out, that I see myself on the table, but I'm still here. And especially back then. I mean, now, you know, when I die, I'd be like, okay, there's point three, point four, okay, point four. You know, we expect it almost. But after people calm down, and this is another thing that that brings us some hope. There's a feeling of peace and quiet and stillness and comfort. Extremely pleasant feelings and peaceful feelings in the early near-death experience. One person in the parish who had what we would later call an out-of-body experience. I don't know if it was a near-death experience, but an out-of-body experience. Describe what happened and how this person's consciousness left their body after a very serious operation, and the person was feeling not well at all, feeling very ill after a cardiac operation, and began to feel him or herself leave the room, okay, and came back and body was fine. And this person said, you know, ever since then, when a loved one passes away, this gives me comfort. And he's experienced something that's beyond just this flesh. Okay. They are common. They are common experiences. The noise. Some people hear a loud buzzing or ringing. It's often unpleasant. As Moody reports, it's usually about the time when the consciousness is leaving the physical body. There's kind of this build up. And then, of course, we have the dark tunnel. We'll look at another model probably next week of 12, kind of a revised model of this. It's interesting. And you see how these things kind of change. And, you know, this is based on many, 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 many people's different experiences and trying to make them all similar and fit together. In Moody's experience, the dark tunnel and then coming into the light was the soul or the consciousness leaving the body. Now it seems to be that people are more often having that experience as they leave the realm around their body. They may be floating around their body for a while, and then when it's time to go somewhere else, then they go through the tunnel. So these things aren't really nailed down. These things are kind of fluid. Okay, the tunnel, out of body, consciousness, including sense perceptions, exist outside the physical body. Those who've experienced a near-death experience frequently feel their consciousness leave their physical body, and they see their bodies often from the outside. Okay, and sense perceptions are different. Primarily vision. Okay, we tend to think of, I see with my eyes, I think with my brain, I hear with my ears. The Orthodox teaching and what this certainly points to is the soul is where the consciousness resides. The soul is what sees. The soul is what gives light. The soul is what hears. The soul is what communicates. And while we're in the body, the soul uses the brain to think. The soul uses the eyes to see. The soul uses the ears to hear. And if you punch me in the ear or stick a fork in my eye, I can't see out of that eye or hear out of that ear anymore. If I'm born mentally handicapped or I get a disease that ravages my brain, you know, I'm in a so-called vegetative state. Because the vehicle through which the soul and the consciousness interacts with this world is impaired. Okay? But at the moment that the soul is separated from the body, it sees. It hears. It thinks faster and better than it ever did in the flesh. Okay? Some of these things, and none of these guys talks about this, these things have, if they believe what they believe, if what they're finding is true, this has radical implications for our medical practices and our moral practices. Abortion should be made immediately illegal. It should be made capital offense, perhaps. Not a capital. Maybe. I mean, because, as we're going to find in another book, there is consciousness, there is a soul, there is life, there's a person there. Even at 1 month, even at 2 months in the womb, we'll learn that. The person, we pull the plug, you know, our technology allows us to keep people alive way too long. Terry Schiavo, remember that thing? And they pulled the plug and said, well, thank God, she was freed from all that. But this tells us that that is a person. And they may be limited because of their physical capabilities, but they have a mind. They have a brilliant consciousness that in this life isn't able to interact with the world and learn things like we can, but it's there. Okay, so the big organ harvesting. Think about that. You know, we've been talking about that, that they keep people alive to harvest their organs. They're unconscious, and then, you know, then they're gonna see us doing that, and they're gonna be pretty shocked. They'll get over it though. That's a nice thing. They'll get over it pretty quick. They'll be like, you know, I don't really want to go back. Don't need a kidney anyway, you know. Okay. 7, meeting others. Often seeing loved ones. And this is important, almost always who have already died. Okay? I'll come back to that point maybe next week. A being of light. This is described as the most common element and the most profound element of the near-death experience. It's a being of light that communicates directly through thought, and they feel feelings of overwhelmed love and acceptance, often with the person during the review stage. We'll talk about that. Like, again, I'm redundant. It's the most commonly, of all the points that these 50 people experienced, the being of light was the most common. They all shared. Okay. The review, the life review, described most often as an extremely thorough yet almost instantaneous review of one's life, primarily non-judgmental. Most report a "how do you think your life went" experience of the review. People, though, do experience greater empathy for others. They meet with the being of light, they see their life, some every detail, some the highlights of their life flash before them. Usually these are things they can't remember. I mean, when this happens to me, I'll be like, oh wow, I forgot. I mean, my memory is so bad. They remember things are brought up. It's not a product of their mind. It's not their memory. At least that's what the studies seem to say. Someone is guiding them through this experience. It is non-judgmental. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But the people are able to see what they do, and often they can feel what happened as a result of their actions. If Mark and I are there and I punch Mark on the nose, I have a near-death experience or die, I will probably be shown that again. And then I will feel and know what Mark was going through. Okay? A greater empathy, kind of being inside of his head, walking in his shoes. Okay? Then they often come to a border or a limit. It's a kind of barrier that they cannot cross, though at this point they want to. They want to go across. They come to something, a visual barrier, or they just feel it, and sometimes their loved ones are waiting for them on the other side. They want to cross, and they know that if I cross, I'm not coming back to my body. If I cross, I'm dead. And not one of the many bits and pieces of these that I've read has anyone not wanted to cross. That's another thing that we can take hope for, you know. We just had that experience in Newtown, that massacre. It's like, you know, we're sad, but especially beyond this, we know they're innocent, so they're going to heaven. But it didn't take long for them, their consciousness that never for a moment ceased. People don't want to come back. But sometimes the being of light or something is like, I need to go back to take care of my family. though I don't really even want to, and they feel guilty about that, you know. Or, but most people just simply don't want to come back. They're kind of forced to come back. Some people are given a choice. Okay, coming back. Often describe the cold physical shock, the pain, none of which is happening during the near-death experience itself when the consciousness re-enters the body, and often they wake up days later in the case of ICU-type experiences. So if they're doing chest compressions on me, I come back into my body, I'm not conscious of that. I'll wake up a day or two later in the hospital. So there, once the consciousness, the soul has come back into the body, it becomes unconscious because I'm in the body again, and the body is the means through which I'm experiencing and observing the world around me, okay? But very important. They come back in the body. The body's cold. It's restrictive. It's a shock. They feel pain. None of that did their soul or their consciousness feel while it was outside of the body, okay? Telling others near-death experiences, want to share their amazing experience, but are often met with skepticism. As I say, at least in the mid-1970s, pre-Oprah, and they remain quiet about their near-death experience. And this has really changed. It's really changed. Now people who have them, they want to talk about them. They want to share. They feel like they're an apostle. They've got a gospel. I could share. Your brother. Does he know that we're doing the class?
Yeah. He called it. He was supposed to be here. I don't know where he's at.
He was going to come?
Yeah, he's coming.
Okay. His brother had this experience. And he wanted to come and share. I hope he gets to. But Oprah and this book has made this now part of popular culture. Okay? Effects on lives. When people come back, there's often a positive and deep change that occurs in the person's life. They describe being more loving and compassionate, and they reevaluate their values. Okay? They have new views of death. Most no longer fear death, though they still admit that the process of dying is uncomfortable up until the moment of death, but they don't fear death anymore. And then corroboration, the last point. Things that the person viewed during their near-death experience or out-of-body experience are often corroborated in detail. Okay? Any questions?
When did the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze come out? That sounds like... That sounds like this is the explanation.
Came out.
They used this format to make the movie, right?
That came out, yeah. You see, in 1990 or 1991, I remember that because I went to that movie for prom. That was my prom movie. I hated prom. And I'm still not fond of Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze. Or... what's her name?
Whoopi Goldberg.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Is this like 1 through 15, the way that, like the 50 of them thought that it was...
No, what he's saying is, okay, what he's saying there is, say this is a near-death aholics, 12-step group, okay? We all have near-death experiences, and I'm going to write down what they all are. Okay, okay. You experience maybe 7 or 8 of those.
So it's not...
He experiences 13 of them. You experience 10 of them. You experience 12 of them. You experience... But then I'm like, okay, if I put all the stuff together, I say, oh, there's 15 pretty common points. You know, not any one of you had all 15 of them happen. Not any one of you reported that all 15 happened. But most of you had most of them happen. Most of you had 7 or 8 of them happen, but it may be a different 7 or 8.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I put them together, and so he's making this, he's putting this together. Okay. Moody's conclusions. Okay. Are there any historical examples of near-death phenomena? Yes, this is Moody. As far as I know, there are not. However, since I've been fully occupied with contemporary instances, I have simply not had the time to adequately research this question. So I would not at all be surprised to find that such reports have been recounted in the past, and lo and behold, they have. On the other hand, I strongly suspect that near-death experiences have been vastly more common in the past few decades than in earlier periods, and I would concur with this. The reason for this is simply that it has only been in fairly recent times that advanced resuscitation technology has been available. Now we can bring people back from the dead. For a while. Depending on if their heart stopped or something else happened. Yeah. but he admits that he hasn't known this. So he is making conclusions from what he's observing. He doesn't have any teaching religiously to form his observations, except for a liberal kind of Methodist secular humanist view. You know, basically, he's a doctor in the 70s, secular humanist, okay? With a little bit of religion, a little bit of spirituality, much more after he did this study. So he's observing these things that are happening, and so maybe he's coming up with a flat earth. Maybe he's coming up with a spherical earth. Maybe he thinks, in terms of near-death experience, well, you know, this all fits together, and the earth is in the middle, and the sun's going around. Well, maybe he's getting it right. Not sure. But anyway, he has a contemporary worldview informed a lot by secular humanism, and that's kind of helping him put his observations together. Okay.
But his conclusion here is wrong, is it not?
What?
That as far as he knows, there are not.
Oh, yeah, no. What I'm saying is, because there are not, because he doesn't know of any, what I'm saying is, he doesn't know of this rich literature that we have in Orthodoxy. The unbelievable to many, I emailed that to the guy we're going to talk about next week. I never heard back from him, but I said, here's something to put on your website, because he has over 1,000 reports of near-death experiences on his website. And that fits a lot of what we've talked about, but it's different in some very important ways. What I'm saying is, because he doesn't have a knowledge of other things, he's putting this together from a way a modern man would understand it. And then he's like, well, okay, the Bible's good, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is good, some of these other occultist sources are good, and they're, you know, so that's what he's doing. Does that make sense? Okay. A common challenge posed by near-death experiences. So,
just one other thing.
Okay.
To comment on what he said. It also, when he says, I have not had the time to research what might have happened before,
right. Right.
Adequately researched, that's also a way to step into selling my book that this is something new. And I can sell 2 million copies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
This is brand new stuff. Yeah. This didn't happen before. Let me sell you this.
Yeah.
I mean.
And he sold 2 million copies.
It worked.
And more since then. Yeah.
It worked.
Okay. It worked. Yes, it did. A common challenge posed by near-death experiences. Okay. Indeed, many persons have stressed how unlike their experiences were to what they had been led to expect in the course of their religious training. A lady who had an out-of-body experience after severe injury said, "The strange thing was that I had always been taught in my religious upbringing that the minute you died, you would be right before those beautiful gates, those pearly gates. But there I was hovering around my physical body, and that was it. I was just baffled." Okay? This seems kind of silly, but this is serious stuff. People have been told, you die, you go straight to heaven. I mean, that's not in the Bible. And in the teaching of the church, and when we have the 3-day memorial, the 9-day memorial, the 40-day memorial, we have in the church, not as theological teaching, but as custom, as tradition, that, yeah, the soul leaves the body, and then it might be there for a while. And then it goes somewhere else. Not on its own. Soul never goes beyond this earth and this realm on its own. It's always accompanied by angels. It's not self-locomotive, Eben Alexander. Okay.
Even with butterflies.
Maybe, especially not with butterflies and Whoopi Goldberg. If Whoopi Goldberg was on there, no way. Sorry, Whoopi. This is serious. Caused her to challenge, and we'll see, faith, on challenges that near-death experiences pose to common but deeply held misconceptions. even those who previously had some traditional conviction about the nature of the afterlife world seem to have moved away from it to some degree, following their own brushes with death. In fact, in all the reports I have gathered, not one person has painted the mythological picture of what lies hereafter. No one has described the cartoonist heaven of pearly gates, golden streets, and winged harp-playing angels, nor a hell of flames and demons with pitchforks.
Left out purgatory.
Interesting. So people, you know, so what he's saying is, in the mythology, the Christian mythology of our culture, it's like, I die, I'm in heaven, or I die, I'm in a bad place. And I've just died, and hey, I'm still here. I can still see all of you. In fact, they're often, they try and, you know, touch, and they can't. They don't have physical bodies anymore. They're conscious. They try and speak, and no one can hear them. And they freak out, but then they're comforted. Then they're okay. But if you're expecting, I'm saved, once saved, always saved, then boom, I go to... And that's why I have a hard time putting 90 minutes in heaven into all this, because he's, boom, it happened. It reinforced his worldview. But a lot of people... Where is Jesus? Where are the angels? Why am I here? And then they come back. And because they have misconceptions about the journey after death, they have a crisis of faith. Okay? That's the problem with heresy. That's the problem with wrong teaching about God, even about something as relatively unimportant as what happens to us with the process of dying. And what these guys are finding, what these researchers have found in the last few decades, is more true about the immediate state after death than the mythological picture of, I go to heaven immediately. Okay? Because, and we know that, because where's heaven? Ask a kid, where's heaven? It's up. It's up. Wherever we're standing on earth, it's up. It doesn't mean it's behind some cloud somewhere, but it's in a different place. And to get to heaven, to get to a different realm, I mean, when the soul leaves the body, it's still on earth. It's in the unseen realm around us, but it's not heaven, and it has to be taken to heaven. But it has to be taken to heaven. They don't like that there's no hell for these guys. How commonly held misconceptions of the researchers may unconsciously influence their own interpretations of the data. In most cases, says Moody, the reward-punishment model of the afterlife is abandoned and disavowed. I want nothing to do with that reward-punishment model that I was taught in Sunday school, even by many who have been accustomed to thinking in those terms. They found, much to their amazement, that even when their most apparently awful and sinful deeds were made manifest before the being of light, the being responded not with anger and rage. How twisted is this guy's vision of who God is? Heaven and hell is reward and punishment. That's not orthodox. And God is angry and enraged at you because of your sin. He's a mean, abusive father. And they don't experience that. And lo and behold, but rather this being of light, as we're seeing our life unfold before us, stands beside us only with understanding and even with humor. Red flag. Serious red flag. He just killed some people in a grade school. It's okay. You just killed some people in that movie theater. It's okay. I mean, God loves those guys too, but it's not okay. In place of this old model, the reward-punishment model of old Sunday school teaching, many seem to have returned with a new model and a new understanding of the world beyond, a vision which features not unilateral judgment. And it's important. Maybe we need to talk about God's judgment, what it really is. It's not an angry judgment. It's just responsibility. for what we do, but rather cooperative development towards the ultimate end of self-realization.
He turned into an academic on us, didn't he?
He turned into Oprah Winfrey. I mean, you know what I mean? So in this model now, I'm unpacking this too early, aren't I? Okay. I'm unpacking all this too early. But anyway, without a understanding of a God who is love, and that love is judgment of responsibility and the free will, the greatness of free will, but the burden of free will, and that we will be held account for everything. Not that God's trying to zap us, but we did it, and it's known. It's affected the universe. It's affected those around us, and God will say, yes, this happened, and there's a result for that. I mean, that's the message of the Bible. I mean, it's not an angry God. It's not reward, punishment. It's just... cooperative development towards the ultimate end of self-realization.
Those last two words, I mean, there's...
that's a big...
transactional break. Psychology and secular humanism. Going right to it. I just have a hard time with this stuff.
Next. Evidence of the afterlife. The largest scientific study of near-death experiences ever conducted. Okay. So, any questions or comments or concerns? You know, the first 2 weeks, that handout will be good for next week as well. We're being introduced to the material. Because we shouldn't throw this stuff out. We should use it. It should give us comfort to some degree. Do I believe that what they are finding is true? There are people, and in the books it talks about this, who, when they describe, they're in a Catholic hospital. My soul left my body, I looked down, I saw myself, and I saw them resuscitating. And you know, there's a nun or someone comes in, that was a vision, that was the devil, honey. That was the devil. That was the demon. That was the devil. That didn't happen. Okay? If we told that to Norman, probably he would not react well. No. Because he knows it was real. To him, it's probably the realest thing that's ever happened to him.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
It's the real. Because it's ineffable. It's beyond, but can we affirm, can I as an Orthodox priest affirm what I think Norman is going to tell us? And a lot of what these guys are finding, yes. Yes. In what they're observing. Not necessarily in how they're putting it together and the bigger view of the world that gives them. We're going to talk about that more next time. But in what they're observing, and yes. As we go further into the experience, then it gets a little more, okay, we need some discernment. But
it seems like, based on what you presented here about Moody, that he then takes it and it's really colored by his own frame of reference.
Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely.
He did okay in the clinical
part. He's taking the data. So the point about the paradigm of observation is there's data. There's evidence. Is it real? Yes. But how we understand it and the picture that we put together with it may be correct, maybe not correct. May leave a flat earth, maybe a globe, you know. So what I'm saying is here, maybe a lot of the data, all of the data is happening. I believe that all of these things are happening. Not all of them are necessarily good or what they seem to be, but they're happening. But to understand more deeply, we have to have some other sources help us out. Okay. Anyone else? Any thoughts, questions, concerns? Okay. And it will get more interesting. It'll get... Oh, Denise.
Well, I was just speaking of the near death, but would some... none of these people here would they have been in a coma?
Yes. Yes.
Or like you said,
yes.
It comes back. And
yes.
Then, you know, you don't wake up or whatever for a day or two.
Yes.
So that would be more or less where they got their information.
Mm-hmm. I think where we need to draw the line later, and they don't draw that line. So they're researching near death experiences where someone comes close to death. They're also researching out of body experiences that someone's consciousness leaves their body while they're in a coma. You know, some people are in a traumatic car wreck. They're thrown from the car and their soul leaves their body. And they come back into it a couple minutes later. Okay? I think those things happen. We'll talk a little bit more later. But I think we need to distinguish between that and someone who actually dies and comes back. So I'll use this word, this term later, an after-death experience. That someone who, so these guys are taking people who have died and come back, people who have had serious trauma and come back, people who were taking a nap and had an out-of-body experience and came back, and kind of painting a picture. And what I'm saying is we need to distinguish between that, between those things that happen while we're still, the body is alive, and because something's happening there too. But distinguish that from what is happening to the soul after the body is dead. Okay? Because there's a difference.
So a large percentage of...
Does that make sense? Yeah. Right.
And I'm sure there'll be more later, but yeah.
Yeah.
So a large percentage of Moody's subjects weren't actually pronounced dead. They never got,
I get the feeling,
far.
About half.
Far.
The others were experiencing serious trauma. He goes on later in books that I have not read and not interested in looking at the out-of-body experience. The near-death experience, people, out-of-body means soul consciousness leaves the body. Okay, that might be a near-death or after-death experience. The body's clinically dead. It might be, I'm taking a nap, and you know, not really. Or I'm in a coma or something. So he's going back after this book and researching people who had like a life-threatening situation and experienced this, but they didn't die, and maybe they weren't even physically hurt. Maybe they were, and they kind of put it all together.
Yeah, at least two out of these three books, nobody was pronounced dead.
Right,
they were just, you know, it was trauma. Or they were
near, very near death. Yes,
right. But they never actually.
So those would be out-of-body experiences. And we can learn something from them, but I think in the church we have to distinguish them between a death experience, okay? And even the near-death experiences, it's not their time yet. God is sending them back for a reason, or they're coming back for a reason. I think the good things that we can take away from is secular science is now showing us, though there's a big challenge to it. We'll talk about that next week some. There is a soul. It survives after death. Love makes the world go round. We'll see our dead loved ones again. In this way or not. We'll talk about that. Once the soul leaves the body, there's no pain. The vision, they describe the vision. If you want me to stop so you can go home, just tell me. People can see very far. They're not limited by their eyes. They could see very far. Now, they also talk about being able to focus in on something in particular, just like we do, you know, my whole vision. But they could see very far. They can move very quickly. You know, it talks about people, I want to go here, and they're there, you know, three blocks away. Some people talk about 360-degree vision. They can see all around them because the soul isn't seeing through eyes anymore. But it's still focused on, you know, I could, like, I'm aware of all of you, but I'm looking at Mark. That's kind of how it works. This is where my mind is focused. But they can see all around them. You know, they have these things. the brain, the mind is, you know, the life flashing before your eyes that we have, you know, when I had the big one, Archie Bunker, life's going before my eyes, or whoever said that. That's real in this life review thing, but also in the fact that once the consciousness, the soul, is separated from the body, it works at, it's not limited by how fast my neurons can fire, how fast the chemicals in my brain, you know. I can get from here to there. The limit is how fast can I run and how long can I run that fast.
So it's unspoken communication.
The soul, right, right. I can think, but then I have to speak to you. I can't just think and you hear it. That changes. The soul lives, and it's a great thing. It's a glorious thing. And I think that when people describe the love, the light, it's an amazing experience. And they kind of begin to connect that with something spiritual or with God or something. Because they don't have this teaching, and maybe because they haven't had similar spiritual experiences while in the flesh, because the saints have those. I mean, the saints have this to a degree. They think it's God. They think it's something special, when really it might very well just be you are feeling how wonderful, how unlimited, how free the soul naturally feels and is when it's not weighed down by a physical body. And you're saying, oh, it's other things, but it might just be this is how it feels to be unlimited in the soul and not trapped in flesh. Other questions? Okay,
Matt. I have a question. When you're talking about the soul having a different, you know, vision, stuff like that, are there any of the cases where it's been a blind person or a deaf person that has had an experience and came back and described?
Look on page 6 of your...
Page 6?
Yeah, the last page. No, of your handout. Yeah, we didn't get to that. Absolutely. Next week we're going to talk about blind sight. The third of 9 lines of evidence that Jeffrey Long, MD, says gives us absolute irrefutable proof of the afterlife. Yes. Great question. Yes, it happens. But imagine not having vision, and then all of a sudden you have it. We can imagine being blind, kind of, because we can imagine what it's like to be blind, because we've had sight. A blind person from birth or from infancy cannot imagine, they have no concept of what it is to see. They describe that as like, I guess I was seeing, but I have no idea what that is. They have no idea what color is. They have no idea to put into words. Sight is ineffable. Sight is inexpressible. They have no words. They have no mental concepts for what it means to see. And so some of them come back and it's like, did they see or not? Well, yeah, a few of them are able to say, yes, that must be what light is. That must be what it's like to see. But a lot of them are just like, oh, you know? So, yeah. Yeah. Great question.